Last night, actually, all week long, they've been playing the Da Vinci Code on this particular cable station. I don't know. How many of you have seen the Da Vinci Code or read the book? Okay, that's most of you. You know, it came out, I think the book came out, what, 5, 6, 7 years ago, something like that. I remember when it came out and it created this big stir and all. And just 2 weeks ago, I had a woman here at the Effect come up to me and say that when she first read that book all those years ago, that was the moment that she stopped going to church. She totally questioned her Christianity. Everything didn't make, nothing made sense anymore. And if you don't know the plot of the thing, it's a conspiracy theory kind of scavenger hunt that goes throughout Europe and all over the place. But it's based on the premise that Jesus and Mary Magdalene were husband and wife, and she was pregnant at the time of the crucifixion. And so the grail, the Holy Grail, rather than being the chalice that held the blood of Christ, was actually symbolic of Mary's womb, which held the bloodline of Christ. And of course, the church covered it up, and there's this big conspiracy theory and all of these things about it. And as I was watching, I watched, I think, the second half of it. I got stuck in it, and I watched it. And I realized that this movie kind of encapsulates and puts on display all the worst of what the church has to offer. All the things that are wrong with church. I mean, here, everything about faith is portrayed as something that is existing in the dim past. You know, they're walking through these old churches with these dusty crypts and looking through bones, and they're trying to find DNA evidence to prove this thesis. And of course, the church is coming against them and is willing to kill to protect what exactly? The power structure of the church itself. And everything is focused on the dim past, on the future. And what kept coming to mind as I was watching this is what Jesus said to the women that came to the tomb on Easter Sunday. He said, "Why are you looking for the living among the dead?" You know, and yet we do this, don't we? We continue to look for life. We continue to look for God amidst the dusty bones of death. And we continue to make our faith into something that is some sort of a creed that hangs on the wall, but it doesn't affect our lives in any real way. And actually, this woman that I talked to 2 weeks ago, I told her, you know, that was really a blessing in disguise. For you to hit that book at that particular moment, to cause you to question everything that you had been doing before, to realize that everything you had been doing before didn't make any sense anymore, and that you needed to jump forward, you needed to break through, because here she is back at church now several years later, but with a renewed passion, a renewed vigor, a renewed just essential connection that she needs to have with her God that wasn't present before. And so we don't need to be afraid of any of these things that come down the pike, these things that question the origins of Christianity, that question our faith. We can use them to springboard into ever deeper expressions of our faith. But why do we look for the living among the dead? I mean, that's something that we really need to think about. And that's what following your bliss is really all about. Last week we talked about it, and I know several of you or many of you weren't here last week. And we were talking about God's will. That's really what kicked this whole thing off. And we were saying that we spend so much time trying to find God's will in our life that it makes us nuts, you know. And it's as if that God had a perfect plan for our lives, but he's not telling. And so we got to try to figure it out, and we got to execute it perfectly. And if we don't, we will always be less than. So here is God playing hide and seek with his will. Well, God doesn't do that. You know, we wouldn't do that to our children. God doesn't do it to us. God's will is hiding in plain sight. God's will is perfectly accessible. And we all know what it is, but we're looking for something that we need to do in the future, something that will be grand, something that God has for us, whether it's a husband or a wife or a job or a ministry or a cause or whatever it may happen to be. But when we're looking toward the future, we're missing the present. And that's the point that Jesus was trying to make. God's will, as we discussed last week, is not a what. It's not what you do. God's will is a how. It's how you do what you do that puts you in the center of God's will. And I went so far as to say that I don't think God cares what we do. He only cares how we do it. Augustine said, "Love God and do as you please." Now, there's a pretty scary thing, huh? Because what I please gets me into trouble all the time, doesn't it? But if we really do the first part of that, If we really are loving God, it's going to automatically limit the things that we please to do. In other words, our will is lining up with God's will. And when we pray according to God's will, right? Pray as if God was praying, if God were praying, then it's always the definition of an answered prayer. This is what we tried to get through about will last week. But then, the question comes up. If God doesn't care what we do, then what do we do? What do we do? All things being equal, we said, follow your bliss. Follow that thing in you that has the passion and the drive that will take you through. The thing that pops you up like a piece of toast in the morning that you cannot wait to get to that thing. That's your bliss. It's that activity. It's that profession. It's that, whatever. What's the word I want? It's that talent that you have that you can exercise that gives you a sense of meaning and purpose and connection with everyone around you. Follow your bliss. Now that caused a whole other set of questions. And I got a lot of them out here in the courtyard right after the service last week. And then they kept coming up. And Jeff asked me if I would really spend some time talking about this notion of following your bliss. Because what does it really mean? How does it play out in our lives? You know, it's one thing to get the general principle, but how it filters down into the details of every moment of your life is another thing altogether. And so I did want to talk about that today. And I do want to answer some of the questions that came up during the week. And we'll see how I do here. The thing about following your bliss that hits you right off the bat is that it sounds selfish, doesn't it? Follow your bliss. We have a tradition in Christianity of this idea of the suffering servant. You know, the Isaiah passage that purports to Jesus and the nation of Israel. This idea that if there's no pain, that there's no gain. That we really do need to pick up our cross and follow Christ. That we need to enter into his suffering, you know, in order to be able to be identified with him. And this goes right back to the foundations of the early church. And it's been with us ever since. I mean, even in the Da Vinci Code, that one main character is a self-flagellate. The guy who is beating himself and he wears a cilice. You know, that metal shirt that keeps him in constant pain. The idea was, if you were in pain, you were connecting with the wounds of Christ. You know, there is this kind of sick understanding about what it means to be identified with Christ. Think about this. You read a newspaper, and you read a story about a heroic fireman who rushed into a burning building and saved a bunch of people and got them out in time. And then a few days later, or a week later, you read another article that says that same fireman was the one who set the fire in order to be able to play the hero later on. How do you feel about him now? See, we don't have to set fire to our lives to experience pain. Have you guys figured that out yet? There'll be plenty of pain coming down the pike. We don't need to do that ourselves. And if we seek it out, then we have the same sort of mindset that fireman who set the fire does. This is nothing that God would ever have for us. God is not happy when we suffer. But God knows that suffering is an integral part to our becoming complete and mature. James 1, right? Count it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various temptations and trials, because these are the things that are going to perfect you. But we don't have to go looking for them. You know? What do I have right there in the beginning of the bulletins there, the John 10:9? Jesus says, I am the door. If anyone enters through me, he will be saved and will go in and out and find pasture. I came that they may have life and have it abundantly. What part of abundantly don't we understand? God wants that for us. He wants us to be following our bliss. He knows that it isn't always going to be that way. That circumstances outside of our control will intervene. The ramifications, the consequences of our actions will overtake us. He knows these things are going to happen. And how we negotiate those, how we deal with them, has everything to do with our maturity. But we don't need to go looking for them. What I'm trying to tell you, it's okay to follow our bliss. And let's read the next section there from Joseph Campbell, who's the one who really proposed all this in the first place. My general formula for my students is follow your bliss. Find where it is, and don't be afraid to follow it. If you do follow your bliss, the life that you ought to be living is the one you are living, wherever you are. If you are following your bliss, you are enjoying that refreshment, that life within you all the time. When you can see that, you begin to meet people who are in your field of bliss, and they open doors to you. I say, follow your bliss and don't be afraid, and doors will open where you didn't know they were going to be. Do you think Jesus followed his bliss? Absolutely. There's also this thread in Christianity that feels that Jesus came to suffer and to die. That was his purpose in coming to earth, to suffer and to die. But to me, that makes no sense. What Jesus came was to live and to show us how to live in perfect love. But he wasn't afraid and he didn't shrink back from accepting the hardships that his bliss called him to. Jesus lived his life as an itinerant teacher and a healer, as a rabbi among his people. That was his bliss. Obviously it was, because he was willing, you know, Da Vinci Code notwithstanding, to forego hearth and home and wife and family in order to be able to be everything he needed to be for the people for whom he was teaching. That was his bliss. There was nothing else he would rather do than that. But it created hardships. Well, hardships, isn't it supposed to be bliss? What's the definition of bliss anyway? Well, if you look it up, it's going to tell you it's complete, consummate happiness. That's bliss. But we're never going to experience that all the time, are we? So let's come up with a sort of working definition of bliss here. And it's right there also on your sheets. Following your bliss means passionately practicing an activity or profession or trade that brings meaning and purpose to life and also a sense of pleasure. Pleasure is a huge part of this. If you don't really enjoy the thing that you are trying to do, then it's not really bliss. But at the same time, you know, how do you know if it's really your bliss? Maybe it just feels good at the time. You know, some things feel really good, but feeling good isn't really bliss, totally. Jeff asked me, he said, you know, a lot of the folks that he's working with on the recovery program, their bliss is to drink and to use. Their bliss is to party, you know? So, is that their bliss? Is that what's really working for them? You know, compulsive behavior of any sort, whether it's drinking, using, whether it's gambling, or any sort of compulsive behavior, is a mask over the pain that we are feeling deep down underneath, and maybe not so deep down. It is an anesthetic, you know? It's a pill that we can take that makes us feel better for the moment. That's not bliss. Bliss is never running away from something negative. Bliss is always running towards something positive, toward the thing that you want. That's bliss. If we are taking a temporary leave from the pain through some sort of artificial means, that's not bliss. And we have to understand the difference between the two. Bliss is never a running away from pain or negativity. It's a running toward passion and purpose. Baseline, if bottom line, if your life is miserable and bliss is just seen as a moment of relief from that misery, then that's not bliss. Why? Because bliss is always creative. The next point there. From a part of us made in God's image. Did you get that? Bliss is creative. That's the part of us that is created in God's image, the ability to do that, to create something. It is active, not passive. Connecting, not isolating. It creates tangible things that make life better, both ours and the people around us. If your life remains possible, if your life remains miserable, it means a little bit different. If your life is remaining miserable in the face of you following your bliss, then you got to question the bliss that you're following. Basically, you're putting a Band-Aid over a tumor. You know? You are trying to anesthetize yourself. Just get a soothing break for a while. That's not what we're talking about when we talk about following your bliss. You might say, well, my bliss is movies. I love movies. Okay? Is that just watching movies? Or do you like to make movies? Because sometimes watching movies is just another form of escape, right? Some sort of entertainment, 2 hours where you can sort of forget your problems and then you go back into them again afterwards. Or does your love of movies take you a little bit further? You know, the story of Steven Spielberg is just amazing. This kid back in the 70s, who loved movies so much that he just couldn't get enough of them. And he would take whatever little cameras he could scrounge, and he would shoot these films and run around. And then finally he wheedled his way into Universal Studios and was able to just be on the lot and watch what was happening. And then eventually he got a gig there and was able to do this and that. And, you know, the rest is history. But his love of movies actually drove him someplace. It's active, not passive. It connected him with other people. It created something tangible that gave other people joy, gave other people a break from the things that they were experiencing in their lives. And maybe it's not making movies, acting or directing. Ever watch the Turner Classic Channel with that guy Robert Osborne? I mean, how do you get a gig like this? This guy just talks about movies all day long. But he's dedicated his life to being an archivist and historian, and he knows more about movies than probably anybody on the planet. And now it's turned into a livelihood for him. His bliss, his passion, what he cared about drove him to be able to do that sort of thing. I mean, where do you put your resume for a job like that? You sort of create it as you go, you know? That's what bliss can do for you. Bliss can move you into those areas. You know? God's will and bliss are connected, though. God's will is the how of life. It's living with that other-centeredness. It's living with the awareness of God's presence that gives us that baseline contentment, that allows us to be unafraid to move toward the things that we want to do, the what. The how supports the what, and then the what supports the how later on. When you are doing the thing that you love to do, especially if it becomes a livelihood, to get paid for that which you love to do, what's better than that? How many of us can say that that's really the case? But to be able to do that, when your vocation and your bliss become one, your life is a prayer. And that's what we're talking about as well. And bliss requires no artificial sweeteners or ingredients, like drugs or alcohol or compulsive behavior. Such things actually point to the absence of bliss. If you need to alter your consciousness, it means that you don't like the moment that you're in. You need to change your perception of that moment. You need to move to the past. You need to move to the future. You need to just alter yourself with some sort of artificial stimulant or ingredient. You can't handle the truth, basically, is what it comes down to. That's how you know. When you have to resort to things like that, your compulsive behavior is telling you something is wrong. The how of your life is wrong, and you are not following your bliss. I was talking to someone this week, and he's here from out of state, and he's really homesick. He really wants to go back home, but he knows that he's here for a purpose, at least for a time. But he's kind of keeping everybody at arm's length right now because he knows that he's going home at some point, and he doesn't know how much to dig in here. Even though he may go to school here, may do some other things here, but he's kind of in no man's land. I was telling him, you're like in that spot between the front lines. You're nowhere. You're not there and you're not here. He's kind of pining for his home and the state that he lived in before, and he's not really engaging here either. But he had the presence of mind to tell me that he's afraid to do that. He's afraid to really dig in and immerse here in California because he's afraid that he'll lose who he is. He's afraid he'll lose his identity because he sees himself in that other place. Fascinating, isn't it? I was so proud of him for being able to just say that, to be able to understand that. There was a movie a few years ago, actually a lot of years ago, called Moscow on the Hudson, where Robin Williams plays a Russian saxophone player whose band comes across to the United States during the Cold War, and he defects. And so he ends up staying by and gets political asylum. And then he finds himself, you know, trying to live New York life as a musician and trying to do all the things. And, you know, all of a sudden he's got so much freedom, so much liberty, he doesn't know what to do with himself. And there's this wonderful pivotal scene where he's sitting in his apartment looking over this gritty scene outside in New York. And he says, back in Russia, I did not love my life. I loved my misery. Because it was my misery, and no one could take it from me. Think about it. Everything in life, everything that you spend decades carefully building up, can be taken from you in a moment. There are people now who have lost half the value of their 401ks and their pensions and their savings in this recent, you know, economic crisis. Everything can go. And even when you're at the top of your game, and even when everything is perfect, you can step off a curb and get hit by a bus. Everything can be taken from us. And this makes us crazy. This makes us nuts. This makes us afraid. But the one thing that cannot be taken is our misery. Because the more they try, the miserabler you get. You know what the spiritual life is really all about? The spiritual life is finding the one thing in life that you cannot lose. And it's what Bill was talking about. It's the Father's love. We cannot lose that. There is nothing we can do to turn it up or turn it down. But until we know that, we are living our lives with a baseline fear. We cannot follow our bliss because we're too afraid to step out and try something. And when it comes down to it, the next line there, bliss is not our identity. It's not our identity. It helps us find our true identity by making us present to each moment. When you are following your bliss, when you are in the flow, I mean, think about this. Anything that you love to do, whether it's surfing, whether it's skateboarding, whether it's listening to music, hanging out with your family, if you have a job that you love that well, and you're no longer just even conscious of the presence of time, all of a sudden you look up and 2 hours, 4 hours have gone by. That is full connection into the moment and the Spirit of God. It's not our identity, but it helps us find our identity in moments like that, moments of connection. There was another guy that I talked to a couple months ago. He was also from out of state. He was in the program, the recovery program, and he had a four-year-old daughter back home. And his question was, does he continue to keep working on the program here in California, or should he go home where he can be close to his daughter and be in her life? And it was a real pull for him. He didn't know which way to go. That's a tough one. But the thing that you need to understand is that following our bliss means doing all that is necessary to prepare to perform the activity or profession that we're trying to go into. The preparation and training is not experienced as wasted time, but is part of the bliss itself. If his bliss was to be his daughter, but he could not go home and leave the support group in which he found himself here in California, he wouldn't be able to maintain his sobriety. And without sobriety, there is no relationship. None whatsoever. In order to follow his bliss back to his daughter, he needed to pass through this crucible of his recovery program. He needed to make sure that he set such a solid foundation in his sobriety that he could take that atmosphere of sobriety with him wherever he goes. So when he goes back home, he can be sober for his daughter and have a relationship with her. Your bliss is playing guitar, but you don't want to take lessons or practice. Your bliss is being a medical doctor, but you don't want to go to medical school. You know, your bliss is being a sports figure, but you hate working out. You know, we are going to experience or need to experience the things that will take us to that bliss. But once again, if it really is your bliss, you're not going to experience the preparation as a hardship, as wasted time, as simply a means to an end. You're actually going to enjoy taking lessons because there's a purpose to it. To be able to sit and play and not have to think about where your hands are anymore. You're just lost in the music like everyone else. You don't get there without going through all of the things that it takes in order to get there until your sobriety is just a part of who you are. You can't take it wherever you go. And so, bliss, how does it work? You know, Jeff was also saying, guys in the program, they think that they're being irresponsible by staying in the program when their families are waiting for them back in another state. And maybe it's their bliss, maybe it's their responsibility to go back there quickly, but not until they have prepared themselves to be able to go back into their lives and maintain that. It's the same thing here. You know, we sometimes, this is something interesting that I just want to bring up to you. We sometimes look at the followers of Jesus as having left everything because that's the way the scripture describes it, right? Jesus comes by their nets at the side of the lake and says, follow me. And they drop their nets, they drop and leave everything and they follow Jesus. He walks by the tax collector's booth and says, Levi, follow me. And he drops everything and follows them. And so we have this image of these 12 disciples, plus however many more, leaving their families and following Jesus around the countryside. Is that responsible? Is that following your bliss? See, the thing that we need to understand is that following our bliss is self-defeating if it comes at the expense of those who depend on us. Our bliss can only exist in an atmosphere of kept promises. Jesus would never, ever ask his followers to neglect their families. Of course not. It would fly in the face of everything that he was about. And the scriptures tell us of him coming back to Capernaum all the time, that city by the lake, where Peter lived, where Peter's mother-in-law lived. And so you can see that they were journeying out and coming back. You know, they were taking care of business. They were supporting their families. Sometimes they were supported by the communities in which they went. And then money would have to go home. We have to understand, following our bliss does not come at the expense of those who depend on us. Jesus wouldn't do it, and we can't do it either. These are all the parameters in which our bliss is going to be experienced. Because if we know that we are being irresponsible, if we know that we are not taking care of the people who need us, what kind of bliss is there to experience? Bliss is not who we are, it's what we do. Who are we? We are a people who is accepted and loved by our God. That's who we are. We're connected with him at that level. You know, we are God's sons and daughters, if you want to call it that. That's what that means, that we're accepted and loved. And what we do funnels that acceptance through what we love to do. The two work hand in glove. Bliss is not God's will. God's will is not a what, but a how. Like we said, God doesn't care what we do. But God's will, the how of life, and what we do, the thing that makes us happy, come together in a very real way, if we will allow them to. And bliss is not destiny either, but a choice we make based on natural inclinations, talents, and preferences. And think about it. If God doesn't care what we do, then there is no preconceived plan, no predestined plan for our lives. It's our choice. We can do whatever we want to do. You know, Lisa had a great idea about blueprints. You know, you want to be an architect, and God says, okay, here's a blueprint for that. I don't want to do that. I want to be a ballerina. Okay, well, here's the blueprint for that. You know, maybe that's the way it works. But the point is, there is no one destined plan. The destined plan for us is to live as sons and daughters in that sense of acceptance and love. That's what's destined. So how do you know what your bliss is? How can you possibly figure this thing out? Now, that's several of the questions that were asked to me last week. Well, let me ask you a question. If you could be doing anything right now, without regard to your age, your body type, your available resources, forget all that stuff, just throw it all out. If you could click your heels 3 times and be doing whatever you wanted to do, what would it be? And if you can't answer that question, then you don't know yourself well enough. And it's really important that you find out who you are in terms of what is your natural talent? What are you wired to love to do? Figure those things out. I went on the internet last night and took the Myers-Briggs-Jung personality aptitude test. Have you guys ever done that thing? It's really cool. There's this one, and if you want the web address, I'll give it to you, because it was about 64 questions. But you get through them really fast, and I found out that I'm an introverted intuitive. Sounds kind of scary. But it fit me to a T. And then they go and they say, these are the kind of jobs you would be good at. And what was it? It was teacher. Oh, okay, that's what I do. You know, find out about yourself. Take aptitude tests. Take the personality type tests. You know, who were you when you were 8 or 9 years old? Can you remember? Can you remember what you loved to do? Can you remember what you did with all that time? Can you imagine all the time we had as kids? Wouldn't you kill for some of that time right now? Where we had a whole days at a time just to sit around and do whatever we wanted to do, especially in the summer. Well, what did you do with all that time? Who were you? Were you a quiet, bookish kid that liked to be alone in your room? Or you were the one that was always running around playing? You were the one that was always organizing some kind of neighborhood function? I mean, that tells you a lot about who you naturally are. And part of what the spiritual journey is takes you back around to who you were when you were 8 or 9, before all the hurts came in, before all the pressure came in, before all the need for you to be something other than that occurred in your life. You can figure this out. In fact, what you probably have to do is kiss a lot of frogs too. You know, process of elimination. Try some things. See what works. See what doesn't work. Everything that you can imagine that you think is your bliss is going to look a heck of a lot different when you get on the inside looking out rather than the outside looking in. And it's the same thing with the pastorate. It's the same thing with the church. What I imagined it would be, you know, it's really different. Some things are way better and some things are pretty annoying. But you know what? You deal with that too. I wanted to tell you one other story, and I hope I won't embarrass them, but Marion and I got to spend some time with Catherine and Rick Farrell, and we got to know them a little bit better, and they have an amazing story. They have built a business building custom doors and garage doors, and they started in Oklahoma, and they brought it out here, and it's one of those kind of jobs that you can't put a resume in for. But it was so fascinating to hear how this all developed. And they do really wild stuff. I mean, anything that you can imagine about a door, they can do. They have doors that actually open out this way. They have a door that opens this way so that it creates a shade for you to be able to clean and wax your car and do all these things. They have stuff on hydraulics that does all these other crazy things. And I said, man, you must have like a whole staff of engineers to make this stuff happen. And Catherine said, no, it's all Rick. And Rick chimes in and says, I don't have a degree, I don't have an engineering degree or anything. I just figure out how to do stuff and I do it. I mean, how cool is that? Talk about following your bliss. Talk about something that was innately inside of him, and then it got a chance to be actually realized, not only just in the marketplace, but now they've built a really great business. It's now their livelihood. That's following your bliss. That's just kissing frogs, living life in such a way that you're aware and you're paying attention to the opportunities when they come by. That's what following your bliss is about. And when you have a chance to exercise that thing, like Rick, he was born to be able to do this kind of stuff. He's got that really spooky mind in there that can think all these things through in 3D or something. I don't know. But that's what we're talking about here, is following your bliss. Now, not everything that you try to do is going to become your livelihood like it has for Rick and Catherine. They're really blessed, and they'll tell you, they'll be the first ones to tell you that they are, to be able to have that as their business. Maybe it has to happen in between the raindrops of your life. And you know what? All things are not equal in life. We can't always make a living doing the thing that we really want to do. And we have different seasons in our lives. At different times in our lives, the parameters are open. When you're young, like Josh here, his life is wide open. You know, in his early 20s, he has nothing limiting him. Whatever he purposes to do, he can try. And he can see if it can turn into a livelihood or not. Those of us who are older, those of us who have families and children, we don't have the same opportunity or the same open parameters that Josh does. But then some of you that I know that I've talked to, that have either gone through deaths or divorce or other things, your life is now a do-over. So do it over. Strike out into a whole new direction. Just because you did whatever you did for the last 20 years doesn't mean you need to do it for the next 20. And if your parameters are narrower, find ways to continue to do what you do, because you never know how it's going to turn out. You never know when something that you can create is suddenly going to be something that people want. Anything is possible. But you need to remember that we're doing this in seasons. And as we come to a close here, I wanted to read you a passage from Ecclesiastes, which is one of the most beautiful, I think, and one of the most famous passages in the Bible that speaks to this idea of seasons. And it's good to know that Solomon wrote this at the end of his life, when he had experienced everything there was to experience as the wealthiest man that the world had seen to that time, as tradition tells us. And he looks around and he realizes that death is the great leveler where everything comes back into focus. But he writes, there is an appointed time for everything, and there is a time for every event under heaven, a time to give birth and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to uproot what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to tear down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to throw stones and a time to gather stones. A time to embrace and a time to shun embracing. A time to search and a time to give up as lost. A time to keep and a time to throw away. A time to tear apart and a time to sew together. A time to be silent and a time to speak. A time to love, a time to hate. A time for war and a time for peace. I have seen the task which God has given the sons of men with which to occupy themselves. He has made everything appropriate in its time. He has also set eternity in their hearts, yet so that men cannot find out the work which God has done from the beginning even to the end. I know that there is nothing better for them than to rejoice and to do good in one's lifetime. Moreover, that every man who eats and drinks and sees good in his labor, it is the gift of God. I know there is nothing better for them, for all of us, than to rejoice and to do good in our lifetime. That every one of us who eats and drinks and sees good in all his labor is right in the center of God's will and in the center of our bliss as well. Follow your bliss to the fullest extent at every season in your life. Follow your bliss to the fullest extent that this season in your life will allow. Leave no stone unturned. Don't let your dreams die. Because the day your dreams die is not necessarily the day you die, but it is the day that you stop living. Our dreams are integral. They were placed in our hearts by God. And we need to go and express and experience and create. Don't sell yourself short. Take the time to find out what it is you really love to do, what you're good at, and then experience the possibilities. I love the line from Braveheart that every man dies, every woman dies, but not every man really lives. Let's not be one of those. Let's really live. And let's pray. Father, you have placed in our hearts everything that we need to have an abundant life. And your Spirit provides the ground and the basis and the atmosphere for that abundant life. Help us not to see our lives through a negative sort of viewpoint. Help us not to see the limitations, but to see the possibilities. Help us never to give up moving toward the things that we love to do. Help us to express ourselves in such a way that everyone around us is blessed. Everyone around us is smiling, has a better life because we passed through it. Help us never to leave someone worse off than we found them, always better. Help us to follow our bliss in that manner, that we know that you love us, and unafraid we can move forward and see what life can hold. We thank you for all of this that you give us, constantly showering us with love and possibility, Father. And we thank you in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen. Hey, let's all stand. Thank you.